As morning began here at last, Hayes and Coombs' campaign got a boost from Washington. The leading government monetary authorities, Martin at the Federal Reserve Board, Dillon and Rosa at the Treasury, had all been intimately involved in the previous day's planning for the rescue, and of course, part of the planning had been the decision to let the New York Bank, as the Federal Reserve System's and the Treasury's normal operating arm in international monetary dealings, serve as campaign headquarters. So the members of the Washington contingent had slept at home and come to their offices at the normal hour. Now, having learned from Hayes of the difficulties that were developing, Martin, Dillon, and Rosa pitched in with transatlantic calls of their own to emphasize the extent of America's concern over the matter. But no number of calls from anywhere could hold back the clock, or for that matter, find Dr. Holtrop. And Hayes and Coombs finally had to abandon their idea of having a credit bundle ready in time for an announcement to the world at or near 10 a.m. in New York. And there were other reasons, too, for a fading of the early hopes. As the New York markets opened, the extent of the alarm that had spread around the financial world overnight was only too clearly revealed. The bank's foreign exchange trading desk, on the 7th floor, reported that the assault on the pound at the New York opening had been fully as terrifying as they had expected, and that the atmosphere in the local exchange market had reached a state not far from panic. From the bank securities department came an alarming report that the market for United States government bonds was coming under the heaviest pressure in years, reflecting an ominous lack of confidence in the dollar on the part of bond traders. This intelligence served as a grim reminder to Hayes and Coombs of something they knew already, that a fall of the pound in relation to the dollar could quite possibly be followed in a kind of chain reaction by a forced devaluation of the dollar in relation to gold, which might cause monetary chaos everywhere. If Hayes and Coombs had been permitting themselves any moments of idle reverie in which to picture themselves simply as good Samaritans, this was just the news to bring them back to reality. And then word arrived that the wild tales flying around Wall Street showed signs of crystallizing into a single tale, demoralizingly credible because it was so specific. The British government, it was being said, would announce a sterling devaluation at around noon New York time. Here was something that could be authoritatively refuted, at least in respect to timing, since Britain would obviously not devalue while the credit negotiations were underway. Torn between the desire to quell a destructive rumor and the need to keep the negotiations secret until they were concluded, Hayes compromised. He had one of his associates call a few key Wall Street bankers and traders to say, as emphatically as possible, that the latest devaluation rumor was, to his firm knowledge, false. "Can you be more specific?" the associate was asked, and he replied, because there was nothing else he could reply, "No, I can't." This unsupported word was something, but it was not enough. The foreign exchange and bond markets were only momentarily reassured. There were times that morning, Hayes and Coombs now admit, when they put down their telephones, looked at each other across the table in Coombs' office, and wordlessly exchanged the thought, "It isn't going to be done in time." But, in the best tradition of melodrama, which sometimes seems to survive stubbornly in nature at a time when it is dead in art, just when things looked darkest, good news began to arrive. Dr. Holtrop had been tracked down in a restaurant in The Hague, where he was having lunch with the Netherlands Minister of Finance, Dr. J.W. Witteveen. Moreover, Dr. Holtrop had endorsed the rescue operation, and as for the matter of consulting his government, that was no problem, since the responsible representative of his government was sitting across the table from him. The chief obstacle was thus overcome, and after Dr. Holtrop had been reached, the difficulties began narrowing down to annoyances, like the necessity for continually apologizing to the Japanese for routing them out of bed as midnight arrived and passed in Tokyo. The tide had turned. Before noon in New York, Hayes and Coombs and Lord Cromer and his deputies in London as well, knew that they had agreement in principle from 10 continental central banks, those in West Germany, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Belgium, Switzerland, Canada, Sweden, Austria, and Japan, and also from the Bank for International Settlements. There remained the wait while each central bank went through the painfully slow process of completing whatever formalities were required to make its action legal and proper. The epitome of orderliness, the Bundesbank, could not act until it had obtained ratification from the members of its board of directors, most of whom were in provincial outposts scattered around Germany. The two leading Bundesbank deputies divided up the job of calling the absent directors and persuading them to go along, a job that was made more delicate by the fact that the absent directors were being asked to approve something that, in effect, the bank's home office had already undertaken to do. At mid-afternoon by continental time, while the two deputies were busy at this exercise in double talk, Frankfurt got a new call from London. It was Lord Cromer, no doubt sounding as exasperated as his situation permitted, and what he had to say was that the rate of British reserve loss had become so rapid that the pound could not survive another day. Formalities notwithstanding, it was a case of now or never. The Bank of England's reserve loss that day has never been announced. The Economist later passed along a guess that it may have run to $500 million, or about a quarter of all that remained in Britain's reserve coffers. After Lord Cromer's call, the Bundesbank deputies tempered their tact with brevity. They got unanimous approval from the directors, and shortly after 5 o'clock, Frankfurt time, they were ready to tell Lord Cromer and Hayes that the Bundesbank was in for the requested $500 million. Other central banks were coming in or were already in. Canada and Italy put up $200 million each, and doubtless were glad to do it, inasmuch as their own currencies had been the beneficiaries of much smaller but otherwise similar international bailout operations in 1962 and earlier in 1964, respectively. If a subsequent report in the London Times is to be accepted, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, no one of which ever announced the amount of its participation, each contributed $200 million too. Switzerland is known to have come through with $160 million, and Sweden with $100 million, while Austria, Japan, and the Bank for International Settlements rounded out the bundle with still undisclosed amounts. By lunchtime in New York, it was all over but the shouting, and the last part of the task was to make the shouting as effective as possible to give it the fastest and most forcible impact on the market. The task brought to the fore another Federal Reserve Bank man, its vice president in charge of public information, Thomas Olaf Wagge. Wagge had been present and active in Coombs' office almost all morning, constantly on the phone as liaison man with Washington. A born and bred New Yorker, the son of a Norwegian-born local tug pilot and fishing boat captain, Wagge is a man of broad and unfeigned outside interests, among them opera, Shakespeare, Trollope, and his ancestral heritage, sailing, and one consuming passion, which is striving to convey not only the facts, but also the drama, suspense, and excitement of central banking to a skeptical and often glassy-eyed public. In short, a banker who is a hopeless romantic. So now he was overjoyed when Hayes assigned to him the job of preparing a news release that would inform the world, as emphatically as possible, about the rescue operation. While Hayes and Coombs struggled to tie up the loose ends of their package, Wagge was busy coordinating timing with his counterparts at the Federal Reserve Board and the Treasury Department in Washington, which would share in the issuing of the American announcement, and at the Bank of England, which Hayes and Lord Cromer had agreed would issue a simultaneous announcement of its own. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, New York time, was the hour we agreed upon for the announcements, when it began to look as if we'd have something to announce by that time, Wagge recalls. That was too late to catch the Continental and London markets that day, of course, but it left the whole afternoon ahead until the New York markets closed at around 5. And if the sterling market could be dramatically reversed here before closing time, chances were the recovery would continue on the continent and in London the next day, when the American markets would be closed for Thanksgiving. As for the amount of the combined credit we were planning to announce, it still stood at $3 billion. But I remember that a last-minute snag of a particularly embarrassing sort developed. Very late in the game, when we thought the whole package was in hand, Charlie Coombs and I counted up what had been pledged, just to make sure, and we got only $2,850,000,000. Apparently, we'd mislaid $150 million somewhere. That's just what we'd done. We'd miscalculated, so it was all right. The package was assembled in time to meet the new schedule, and statements from the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and the Bank of England duly went out to the news media simultaneously at 2 p.m. in New York and 7 p.m. in London. As a result of WAGA's influence, the American version, though it fell somewhat short of the mood of, say, the last scene of Die Meistersinger, was nevertheless exceptionally stirring, as bank utterances go, speaking with a certain subdued flamboyance of the unprecedented nature of the sum involved and of how the central banks had moved quickly to mobilize a massive counterattack on speculative selling of the pound. The London release had a different kind of distinction, achieving something of the quintessential Britishness that seems to be reserved for moments of high crisis. It read simply, "The Bank of England have made arrangements under which $3,000 million are made available for the support of sterling." Apparently, the secrecy of the operation had been successfully preserved, and the announcement struck the New York foreign exchange market all of a heap, because the reaction was as swift and as electric as anyone could have wished. Speculators against the pound decided instantly and with no hesitation that their game was up. Immediately after the announcement, the Federal Reserve Bank put in a bid for pounds at $2.78 and 68 one-hundredths of a cent, a figure slightly above the level at which the pound had been forcibly maintained all day by the Bank of England. So great was the rush of speculators to get free of their speculative positions by buying pounds that the Federal Reserve Bank found very few pounds for sale at that price. Around 2:15, there were a strange and heartening few minutes in which no sterling was available in New York at any price. Pounds were eventually offered for sale again at a higher price, and were immediately gobbled up. And thus the price went on climbing all afternoon to a closing of just above $2.79. Triumph! The pound was out of immediate danger. The thing had worked. Tributes to the success of the operation began to pour in from everywhere. Even the magisterial economist was to declare shortly, "Whatever other networks break down, it seems the central bankers have an astonishing capacity for instant results. And if theirs is not the most desirable possible mechanism, geared always to short-term support of the status quo, it happens to be the only working one." So, with the pound riding reasonably high again, the Federal Reserve Bank shut up for Thanksgiving and the bankers went home. Coombs recalls having drunk a martini, unaccustomedly fast. Hayes, home in New Canaan, found that his son Tom had arrived from Harvard. Both his wife and his son noticed that he seemed to be in an unusual state of excitement, and when they asked about it, he replied that he had just been through the most completely satisfying day of his entire working career. Pressed for details, he gave them a condensed and simplified account of the rescue operation, keeping constantly in mind the fact that his audience consisted of a wife who had no interest in banking and a son who had a low opinion of business. The reaction he got when his recital was concluded was of a sort that might warm the heart of a WAGA, or of any earnest explicator of banking derring-do to the unsympathetic layman. "It was a little confusing at first," Mrs. Hayes has said, "but before you were finished, you had us on the edge of our chairs." WAGA, home in Douglaston, told his wife of the day's events in his characteristic way. It was St. Crispin's Day, he exclaimed as he burst through his doorway, and I was with Harry. 3. Having first become interested in the pound and its perils at the time of the 1964 crisis, I found myself hooked by the subject. Through the subsequent 3.5 years, I followed its ups and downs in the American and British press, and at intervals went down to the Federal Reserve Bank to renew my acquaintance with its officers and see what additional enlightenment I could garner. The whole experience was a resounding vindication of Waga's thesis that central banking can be suspenseful. The pound wouldn't stay saved. A month after the big 1964 crisis, the speculators resumed their assaults, and by the end of that year, the Bank of England had used up more than $500 million of its new $3 billion credit. Nor did the coming of the new year bring surcease. In 1965, after a relatively buoyant January, the pound came under pressure again in February. The November credit had been for a term of 3 months. Now, as the term ran out, the nations that had made it decided to extend it for another 3 months, so that Britain would have more time to put its economy in order. But late in March, the British economy was still shaky. The pound was back below $2.79, and the Bank of England was back in the market. In April, Britain announced a tougher budget, and a rally followed, but the rally proved to be short-lived. By early summer, the Bank of England had drawn and committed to the battle against the speculators more than a third of the whole $3 billion. Heartened, the speculators pressed their attack. Late in June, high British officials let it be known that they now considered the sterling crisis over, but they were whistling in the dark. In July, the pound sank again, despite further belt tightening in the British domestic economy. By the end of July, the world foreign exchange market had become convinced that a new crisis was shaping up. By late August, the crisis had arrived, and in some ways it was a more dangerous one than that of the previous November. The trouble was the market seemed to believe that the central banks were tired of pouring money into the battle and would now let sterling fall, regardless of the consequences. About that time, I telephoned a leading local foreign exchange man I know to ask him what he thought of the situation, and he replied, "To my knowledge, the New York market is 100% convinced the devaluation of sterling is coming this fall. And I don't mean 95%, I mean 100%. Then on September 11th, I read in the papers that the same group of central banks, this time with the exception of France, had come through with another last-minute rescue package. The amount not being announced at the time, it was subsequently reported to have been around $1 billion. And over the next few days, I watched the market price of the pound rise, little by little, until, by the end of the month, it was above $2.80 for the first time in 16 months. The central banks had done it again. And somewhat later I went down to the Federal Reserve Bank to learn the details. It was Coombs I saw, and I found him in a sanguine and extraordinarily talkative mood. "This year's operation was entirely different from last year's," he told me. "It was an aggressive move on our part, rather than a last-ditch defensive one. You see, early this September, we came to the conclusion that the pound was grossly oversold. That is, the amount of speculation against it was way out of proportion to what was justified by the economic facts. Actually, during the first 8 months of the year, British exports had risen more than 5% over the corresponding period in 1964, and Britain's 1964 balance of payments deficit seemed likely to be cut in half in 1965. Very promising economic progress. And the bearish speculators seemed not to have taken account of it. They had gone right on selling the pound short, on the basis of technical market factors. They were the ones who were in an exposed position now. We decided the time was ripe for an official counterattack. The counterattack, Coombs went on to explain, was plotted in leisurely fashion this time. Not on the telephone, but face to face, over the weekend of September 5th in Basel. The Federal Reserve Bank was represented by Coombs, as usual, and also by Hayes, who cut short his long-planned vacation on Corfu to be there. The coup was planned with military precision. It was decided not to announce the amount of the credit package this time, in order to further confuse and disconcert the enemy, the speculators. The place chosen for the launching was the trading room of the Federal Reserve Bank, and the hour chosen was 9 a.m. New York time, early enough for London and the continent to still be conducting business on September 10th. At 00:00, the Bank of England fired a preliminary salvo by announcing that new central bank arrangements would shortly enable appropriate action to be taken in the exchange markets. After allowing 15 minutes for the import of this demurely menacing message to sink in, the Federal Reserve Bank struck. Using, with British concurrence, the new bundle of international credit as its ammunition, it simultaneously placed with all the major banks operating in the New York exchange market bids for sterling totaling nearly $30 million. At the then prevailing rate of $2.79 and 18 hundredths of a cent. Under this pressure, the market immediately moved upward, and the Federal Reserve Bank pursued the movement, raising its bid price step by step. At $2.79 and 34 hundredths of a cent, the bank temporarily ceased operations, partly to see what the market would do on its own, partly just to confuse things. The market held steady, showing that at that level there were now as many independent buyers of sterling as there were sellers, and that the bears, speculators, were losing their nerve. But the bank was far from satisfied. Returning vigorously to the market, it bid the price on up to $2.79 and 45 hundredths of a cent in the course of the day. And then the snowball began to roll by itself, with the results I had read about in my newspapers. It was a successful bear squeeze, Coombs told me with a certain grim relish, which was easy to sympathize with. I found myself musing that for a banker to rout his opponents, to smite them hip and thigh and drive them to cover, and not for personal or institutional profit, but rather for the public good, must be a source of rare, unalloyed satisfaction. I later learned from another banker just how painfully the bears had been squeezed. Margins of credit on currency speculation being what they are, for example, to commit $1 million against the pound, a speculator might need to put up only $30,000 or $40,000 in cash. Most dealers had made commitments running into the tens of millions. When a dealer's commitment was £10 million or $28 million, each change of 1/100th of a cent in the price of the pound meant a change of $1,000 in the value of his account. Between the $2.79 and 18 hundredths of a cent on September 10th, then, and the $2.80 and 10 hundredths of a cent that the pound reached on September 29th, such a dealer on the short side of the pound would have lost $92,000, enough, one might suppose, to make him think twice before selling sterling short again. An extended period of calm followed. The air of impending crisis that had hung over the exchanges during most of the preceding year disappeared, and for more than 6 months the world sterling market was sunnier than it had been at any time in recent years. The battle for the pound sterling is now ended, high British officials, anonymous and wisely so, announced in November on the first anniversary of the 1964 rescue. Now, the official said, we're fighting the battle for the economy. Apparently, they were winning that battle too, because when Britain's balance of payments position for 1965 was finally calculated, it showed that the deficit had been not merely halved, according to predictions, but more than halved. And meanwhile, the pound's strength enabled the Bank of England not merely to pay off all its short-term debts to other central banks, but also to accumulate in the open market, in exchange for its newly desirable pounds, more than $1 billion fresh dollars to add to its precious reserves. Thus, between September 1965 and March 1966, those reserves rose from $2.6 billion to $3.6 billion, a fairly safe figure. And then the pound breezed nicely through a national election campaign. As always, a stormy time for the currency. When I saw Coombs in the spring of 1966, he seemed as cocky and blasé about Sterling as an old-time New York Yankee rooter about his team. I had all but concluded that following the fortunes of the pound was no longer any fun, when a new crisis exploded. A seamen's strike contributed to a recurrence of Britain's trade deficit, and in early June of 1966, the quotation was back below $2.79, and the Bank of England was reported to be back in the market spending its reserves on the defense. On June 13th, with something of the insouciance of veteran firemen responding to a routine call, back came the central banks with a new bundle of short-term credits. But these helped only temporarily, and toward the end of July, in an effort to get at the root of the pound's troubles by curing the deficit once and for all, Prime Minister Wilson imposed on the British people the most stringent set of economic restraints ever applied in his country in peacetime. High taxes, a merciless squeeze on credit, a freeze on wages and prices, a cut in government welfare spending, and a limit of $140 on the annual amount that each Briton could spend on travel abroad. The Federal Reserve, Coombs told me later, helped by moving into the sterling market immediately after the British announcement of the austerity program, and the pound reacted satisfactorily to this prodding. In September, for good measure, the Federal Reserve increased its swap line with the Bank of England from $750 million to $1.35 billion. I saw Waga in September, and he spoke warmly of all the dollars that the Bank of England was again accumulating. "Sterling crises have become a bore," the economist remarked at about this time, with the most reassuring sort of British phlegm. Calm again, and again, for just a little more than 6 months. In April of 1967, Britain was free of short-term debt and had ample reserves. But within a month or so came the first of a series of heartbreaking setbacks, two consequences of the brief Arab-Israeli war: a huge flow of Arab funds out of sterling into other currencies, and the closing of the Suez Canal, one of Britain's main trade arteries, brought on a new crisis almost overnight. In June, the Bank of England, under new leadership now, for in 1966, Lord Cromer had been succeeded as governor by Sir Leslie O'Brien, had to draw heavily on its swap line with the Federal Reserve. And in July, the British government found itself forced to renew the painful economic restraints of the previous year. Even so, in September, the pound slipped down to $2.78 and 30 hundredths of a cent, its lowest point since the 1964 crisis. I called my foreign exchange expert to ask why the Bank of England, which in November 1964 had set its last line trench at $2.78 and 60 hundredths of a cent, and which, according to its latest statement, now had on hand reserves amounting to more than $2.5 billion, was letting the price slide so dangerously near the absolute bottom, short of devaluation of $2.78. "Well, the situation isn't quite as desperate as the figure suggests," he replied. "The speculative pressure, so far, isn't anything like as strong as it was in 1964. And the fundamental economic position this year, up to now at least, is much better. Despite the Middle East war, the austerity program has taken hold. For the first 8 months of 1967, Britain's international payments have been nearly in balance. The Bank of England is evidently hoping that this period of weakness of the pound will pass without its intervention. At about that time, however, I became aware of a disturbing portent in the air. The apparent abandonment by the British of their long-standing taboo against bandying about the word devaluation. Like other taboos, this one seemed to have been based on a combination of practical logic. Talk about devaluation could easily start a speculative stampede and thereby bring it on, and superstition. But now I found devaluation being freely and frequently discussed in the British press, and in several respected journals, actually advocated. Nor was that all. Prime Minister Wilson, it is true, continued to follow a careful path around the word, even in the very act of pledging, as he did over and over, that his government would abstain from the deed. There would be no change in existing policy as to overseas monetary matters, he said delicately on one occasion. On July 24th, though, Chancellor of the Exchequer James Callaghan spoke openly in the House of Commons about devaluation, complaining that advocacy of it as a national policy had become fashionable, declaring that such a policy would represent a breach of faith with other nations and their people, and also pledging that his government would never resort to it. His sentiments were familiar and reassuring. His straightforward expression of them was just the opposite. In the darkest days of 1964, no one had said devaluation in Parliament. All through the autumn, I had a feeling that Britain was being overtaken by a fiendish concatenation of cruel mischances, some specifically damaging to the pound and others merely crushing to British morale. The previous spring, oil from a wrecked and wretched tanker had defiled the beaches of Cornwall. Now an epidemic was destroying tens and ultimately hundreds of thousands of head of cattle. The economic straitjacket that Britain had worn for more than a year had swelled unemployment to the highest level in years and made the Labour government the most unpopular government in the post-war era. 6 months later, in a poll sponsored by the Sunday Times, Britons would vote Wilson the fourth most villainous man of the century, after Hitler, de Gaulle, and Stalin in that order. A dock strike in London and Liverpool that began in mid-September and was to drag on for more than 2 months decreased still further the already hobbled export trade and put an abrupt end to Britain's remaining hope of ending the year with its international accounts in balance. Early in November 1967, the pound stood at $2.78 and 0.22 of a cent, its lowest point in a decade. And then things went downhill fast. On the evening of Monday the 13th, Wilson took the occasion of his annual appearance at the Lord Mayor of London's banquet, the very platform he had used for his fiery commitment to the defense of sterling in the crisis 3 years earlier, to implore the country and the world to disregard, as distorted by temporary factors, his nation's latest foreign trade statistics, which would be released the next day. On Tuesday the 14th, Britain's foreign trade figures, duly released, showed an October deficit of over £100 million, the worst ever reported. The cabinet met at lunch on Thursday the 16th, and that afternoon, in the House of Commons, Chancellor Callaghan, upon being asked to confirm or deny rumors of an enormous new central bank credit that would be contingent upon still further unemployment-breeding austerity measures, replied with heat, and with what was later called a lack of discretion, "The government will take what decisions are appropriate in the light of our understanding of the needs of the British economy and no one else's." And that, at this stage, does not include the creation of any additional unemployment. With one accord, the exchange markets decided that the decision to devalue had been taken, and that Callaghan had inadvertently let the cat out of the bag. Friday the 17th was the wildest day in the history of the exchange markets, and the blackest in the 1,000-year history of sterling. In holding it, at $2.78 and 25 hundredths of a cent, the price decided on this time as the last line trench, the Bank of England spent a quantity of reserve dollars that it may never see fit to reveal. Wall Street commercial bankers, who have reason to know, have estimated the amount at somewhere around $1 billion, which would mean a continuous day-long reserve drain of over 2 million per minute. Doubtless the British reserves drop below the $2 billion mark, and perhaps far below it. Late on a Saturday, November 18th, full of confused alarms, Britain announced its capitulation. I heard about it from Waga, who telephoned me that afternoon at 5:30 New York time. As of an hour ago, the pound was devalued to $2.40, and the British bank rate went to 8%, he said. His voice was shaking a little. On Saturday night, bearing in mind that scarcely anything but a major war upsets world financial arrangements more than devaluation of a major currency, I went down to the capital of world finance, Wall Street, to look around. A nasty wind was whipping papers through empty streets, and there was the usual rather intimidating off-hour stillness in that part-time city. There was something unusual, though. The presence of rows of lighted windows in the otherwise dark buildings, for the most part, one lighted row per building. Some of the rows I could identify as the foreign departments of the big banks. The heavy doors of the banks were locked and barred. Foreign department men evidently ring to gain entrance on weekends or use invisible side or rear entrances. Turning up my coat collar, I headed up Nassau Street toward Liberty to take a look at the Federal Reserve Bank. I found it lighted not in a single line, but more hospitably, somehow, in an irregular pattern over its entire Florentine facade, yet it, too, presented to the street a formidably closed front door. As I looked at it, a gust of wind brought an incongruous burst of organ music, perhaps from Trinity Church a few blocks away, and I realized that in 10 or 15 minutes I hadn't seen anyone. The scene seemed to me to epitomize one of the two faces of central banking, the cold and hostile face, suggesting men in arrogant secrecy making decisions that affect all the rest of us, but that we can neither influence nor even comprehend, rather than the more congenial face of elegant and learned men of affairs beneficently saving faltering currencies over their truffles and wine at Basel. This was not the night for the latter face. On Sunday afternoon, Waga held a press conference in a room on the 10th floor of the bank, and I attended it, along with a dozen other reporters, mostly regulars on the Federal Reserve beat. Waga discoursed generally on the devaluation, parrying questions he didn't want to answer, sometimes by replying to them, like the teacher he once was, with questions of his own. It was still far too early, he said, to tell how great the danger was that the devaluation might lead to another 1931. Almost any prediction, he said, would be a matter of trying to outguess millions of people in thousands of banks around the world. The next few days would tell the story. Waga seemed stimulated rather than depressed. His attitude was clearly one of apprehension, but also of resolution. On the way out, I asked him whether he had been up all night. No, last evening I went to the birthday party, and I must say, Pinter's world makes more sense than mine does these days, he replied. The outlines of what had happened Thursday and Friday began to emerge during the next few days. Most of the rumors that had been abroad turned out to have been more or less true. Britain had been negotiating for another huge credit to forestall devaluation, a credit of the order of magnitude of the $3 billion 1964 package, with the United States again planning to provide the largest share. Whether Britain had devalued from choice or necessity remained debatable. Wilson, in explaining the devaluation to his people in a television address, said that it would have been possible to ride out this present tide of foreign speculation against the pound by borrowing from central banks and governments, but that such action this time would have been irresponsible. because our creditors abroad might well insist on guarantees about this or that aspect of our national policies. He did not say explicitly that they had done so. In any event, the British cabinet had, with what grim reluctance may be imagined, decided in principle on devaluation as early as the previous weekend, and then determined the exact amount of the devaluation at its Thursday noon meeting. At that time, the cabinet had also resolved to help ensure the effectiveness of the devaluation by imposing new austerity measures on the nation, among them higher corporate taxes, a cutback in defense spending, and the highest bank rate in 50 years. As for the two-day delay in putting the devaluation into effect, which had been so costly to British reserves, officials now explained that the time had been necessary for conferences with the other leading monetary powers. Such conferences were required by international monetary rules before devaluation, and besides, Britain had urgently needed assurances from its leading competitors in world trade that they did not plan to vitiate the effect of the British devaluation with matching devaluations of their own. Some light was now shed, too, on the sources of the panic selling of pounds on Friday. By no means all of it had been wanton speculation by those famous, although invisible and perhaps non-existent, gnomes of Zurich. On the contrary, much of it had been a form of self-protection, called hedging, by large international corporations, many of them American, that made short sales of sterling equivalent to what they were due to be paid in sterling weeks or months later. The evidence of this was supplied by the corporations themselves, some of them being quick to assure their stockholders that through their foresight they had contrived to lose little or nothing on the devaluation. International Telephone and Telegraph, for example, announced on Sunday that the devaluation would not affect its 1967 earnings because management anticipated the possibility of devaluation for some time. International Harvester and Texas Instruments reported that they had protected themselves by making what amounted to short sales of sterling. The Singer Company said it might even have accidentally made a profit on the deal. Other American companies let it be known that they had come out all right, but declined to elaborate, on the ground that if they revealed the methods they had used, they might be accused of taking advantage of Britain in its extremity. "Let's just say we were smart," was the way a spokesman for one company put it. And perhaps that, if lacking in grace and elegance, was fair enough. In the jungle of international business, hedging on a weak foreign currency is considered a wholly legitimate use of claws for self-defense. Selling short for speculative purposes enjoys less respectability, and it is interesting to note that the ranks of those who speculated against sterling on Friday and talked about it afterward included some who were far from Zurich. A group of professional men in Youngstown, Ohio, veteran stock market players, but never before international currency plungers, decided on Friday that sterling was about to be devalued and sold short 70,000 pounds, netting a profit of almost $25,000 over the weekend. The pounds sold had, of course, ultimately been bought with dollars by the Bank of England, thus adding a minuscule drop to Britain's reserve loss. Reading about the little coup in the Wall Street Journal, to which the group's broker had reported it, presumably with pride, I hoped the apprentice gnomes of Youngstown had at least grasped the implications of what they were doing. So much for Sunday and moral speculation. On Monday, the financial world, or most of it, went back to work, and the devaluation began to be put to its test. The test consisted of two questions. Question one, would the devaluation accomplish its purpose for Britain, that is, stimulate exports and reduce imports sufficiently to cure the international deficit and put an end to speculation against the pound? Question two, would it, as in 1931, be followed by a string of competitive devaluations of other currencies, leading ultimately to a devaluation of the dollar in relation to gold, worldwide monetary chaos, and perhaps a world depression? I watched the answers beginning to take shape. On Monday, the banks and exchanges in London remained firmly closed by government order, and all but a few traders elsewhere avoided taking positions in sterling in the Bank of England's absence from the market. So the answer to the question of the pound's strength or weakness at its new valuation was postponed. On Threadneedle and Throgmorton streets, crowds of brokers, jobbers, and clerks milled around and talked excitedly, but made no trades, in a city where the Union Jack was flying from all flagstaffs because it happened to be the Queen's wedding anniversary. The New York stock market opened sharply lower, then recovered. There was no really rational explanation for the initial drop. Securities men pointed out that devaluation just generally sounds depressing. By nightfall on Monday, it had been announced that 11 other currencies, those of Spain, Denmark, Israel, Hong Kong, Malta, Guyana, Malawi, Jamaica, Fiji, Bermuda, and Ireland, were also being devalued. That wasn't so bad, because the disruptive effect of a currency devaluation is in direct proportion to the importance of that currency in world trade, and none of those currencies were of great importance. The most ominous move was Denmark's, because Denmark might easily be followed by its close economic allies, Norway, Sweden, and the Netherlands, and that would be pretty serious. Egypt, which was an instant loser of $38 million on pounds held in its reserves at the time of devaluation, held firm, and so did Kuwait, which lost $18 million. On Tuesday, the markets everywhere were going full blast. The Bank of England, back in business, set the new trading limits of the pound at a floor of $2.38 and a ceiling of $2.42, whereupon the pound went straight to the ceiling, like a balloon slipped from a child's hand, and stayed there all day. Indeed, for obscure reasons inapplicable to balloons, it spent much of the day slightly above the ceiling. Now, instead of paying dollars for pounds, the Bank of England was supplying pounds for dollars, and thereby beginning the process of rebuilding its reserves. I called Waga to share what I thought would be his jubilation, but found him taking it all calmly. The pound's strength, he said, was technical. That is, it was caused by the previous week's short sellers buying pounds back to cash in their profits, and the first objective test of the new pound would not come until Friday. Seven more small governments announced devaluations during the day. In Malaysia, which had devalued its old sterling-backed pound, but not its new dollar, based on gold, and which continued to keep both currencies in circulation, the injustice of the situation led to riots, and over the next 2 weeks, more than 27 people were killed in them, the first casualties of devaluation. Apart from this painful reminder that the counters in the engrossing game of international finance are people's livelihoods and even their lives, so far so good. But on Wednesday the 22nd, a less localized portent of trouble appeared. The speculative attack that had so long battered and at last crushed the pound now turned, as everyone had feared it might, on the dollar. As the one nation that is committed to sell gold in any quantity to the central bank of any other nation at the fixed price of $35 an ounce, the United States is the keystone of the world monetary arch, and the gold in its treasury, which on that Wednesday amounted to not quite $13 billion worth, is the foundation. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Martin had said repeatedly that the United States would, under any condition, continue to sell it on demand, if necessary down to the last bar. Despite this pledge, and despite President Johnson's reiteration of it immediately after Britain's devaluation, speculators now began buying gold with dollars in huge quantities, expressing the same sort of skepticism toward official assurances that was shown at about the same time by New Yorkers who took to accumulating and hoarding subway tokens. Gold was suddenly in unusual demand in Paris, Zurich, and other financial centers, and most particularly in London, the world's leading gold market, where people immediately began to talk about the London gold rush. The day's orders for gold, which some authorities estimated at over $50 million worth, seemed to come in from everywhere, except presumably from citizens of the United States or Britain, who are forbidden by law to buy or own monetary gold. And who was to sell the stuff to these invisible multitudes so suddenly repossessed by the age-old lust for it? Not the United States Treasury, which, through the Federal Reserve, sold gold only to central banks, and not other central banks, which did not promise to sell it at all. To fill this vacuum, still another cooperative international group, the London Gold Pool, had been established in 1961. Provided by its members, the United States, Britain, Italy, the Netherlands, Switzerland, West Germany, Belgium, and originally France, with gold ingots in quantities that might dazzle a Croesus, 59% of the total coming from the United States, the pool was intended to quell money panics by supplying gold to non-governmental buyers in any quantity demanded, at a price effectively the same as the Federal Reserve's, and thereby to protect the stability of the dollar and the system. And that is what the pool did on Wednesday. Thursday, though, was much worse, with the gold-buying frenzy in both Paris and London breaking even the records set during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, and many people, high British and American officials among them, became convinced of something they had suspected from the first, that the gold rush was part of a plot by General de Gaulle and France to humble first the pound and now the dollar. The evidence, to be sure, was all circumstantial, but it was persuasive. De Gaulle and his ministers had long been on record as wishing to relegate the pound and the dollar to international roles far smaller than their current ones. A suspicious amount of the gold buying, even in London, was traceable to France. On Monday evening, 36 hours before the start of the gold rush, France's government had let slip, through a press leak, that it intended to withdraw from the gold pool. According to subsequent information, France hadn't contributed anything to the pool since the previous June anyhow. And the French government was also accused of having had a hand in spreading false rumors that Belgium and Italy were about to withdraw too. And now it was coming out, bit by bit, that in the days just before the devaluation, France had been by far the most reluctant nation to join in another credit package to rescue sterling. And that, for good measure, France had withheld until the very last minute its assurance that it would maintain its own exchange rate if Britain devalued. All in all, there was a good case for the allegation that de Gaulle and company had been playing a mischievous part, and whether it was true or not, I couldn't help feeling that the accusations against them were adding a good deal of spice to the devaluation crisis. Spice that would become more piquant a few months later, when the franc would be in dire straits and the United States forced by circumstances to come to its aid. On Friday in London, the pound spent the whole day tied up against its ceiling, and thus came through its first really significant post-devaluation test with colors flying. Only a few small governments had announced devaluations since Monday, and it was now evident that Norway, Sweden, and the Netherlands were going to hold firm. But on the dollar front, things looked worse than ever. Friday's gold buying in London and Paris had far exceeded the previous day's record, and estimates were that gold sales in all markets over the preceding 3 days added up to something not far under the billion-dollar mark. There was near pandemonium all day in Johannesburg, as speculators scrambled to get their hands on shares in gold mining companies. And all over Europe, people were trading in dollars not only for gold, but for other currencies as well. If the dollar was hardly in the position that the pound had occupied a week earlier, at least there were uncomfortable parallels. Subsequently, it was reported that in the first days after devaluation, the Federal Reserve, so accustomed to lending support to other currencies, had been forced to borrow various foreign currencies, amounting to almost $2 billion worth, in order to defend its own. Late Friday, having attended a conference at which Waga was in an unaccustomed mood of nervous jocularity that made me nervous too, I left the Federal Reserve Bank, half believing that devaluation of the dollar was going to be announced over the weekend. Nothing of the sort happened. On the contrary, the worst was temporarily over. On Sunday, it was announced that central bank representatives of the gold pool countries, Hayes and Coombs among them, had met in Frankfurt and formally agreed to continue maintaining the dollar at its present gold exchange rate with their combined resources. This seemed to remove any doubt that the dollar was backed not only by the United States' $13 billion gold hoard, but also by the additional $14 billion worth of gold in the coffers of Belgium, Britain, Italy, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and West Germany. The speculators were apparently impressed. On Monday, gold buying was much lower in London and Zurich, continuing at a record pace only in Paris, and this in spite of a sulphurous press audience granted that day by de Gaulle himself, who, along with bemusing opinions on various other matters, hazarded the view that the trend of events was toward the decline of the dollar's international importance. On Tuesday, gold sales dropped sharply everywhere, even in Paris. "A good day today," Waga told me on the phone that afternoon. "A better day tomorrow, we hope." On Wednesday, the gold markets were back to normal, but as a result of the week's doings, the Treasury had lost some 450 tons of gold, almost half $1 billion worth, in fulfilling its obligations to the gold pool and meeting the demands of foreign central banks. 10 days after devaluation, everything was quiet, but it was only a trough between succeeding shockwaves. From December 8th to 18th, there came a new spell of wild speculation against the dollar, leaching another 400 tons or so of gold out of the pool. This, like the previous wave, was eventually calmed by reiterations on the part of the United States and its gold pool partners of their determination to maintain the status quo. By the end of the year, the Treasury had lost almost $1 billion worth of gold since Britain's devaluation, reducing its gold stock to below the $12 billion mark for the first time since 1937. President Johnson's balance of payments program, announced January 1, 1968, and based chiefly on restrictions on American bank lending and industrial investments abroad, helped keep speculation down for 2 months. But the gold rush was not to be quelled so simply. All pledges notwithstanding, it had powerful economic and psychological forces behind it. In a larger sense, it was an expression of an age-old tendency to distrust all paper currencies in times of crisis. But more specifically, it was the long-feared sequel to sterling devaluation, and perhaps most specifically of all, it was a vote of no confidence in the determination of the United States to keep its economic affairs in order, with particular reference to a level of civilian consumption beyond the dreams of avarice at a time when ever-increasing billions were being sent abroad to support a war with no end in sight. The money in which the world was supposed to be putting its trust looked to the gold speculators like that of the most reckless and improvident spendthrift. When they returned to the attack on February 29th, choosing that day for no assignable reason except that a single United States Senator, Jacob Javits, had just remarked, with either deadly seriousness or casual indiscretion, that he thought his country might do well to suspend temporarily all gold payments to foreign countries. It was with such ferocity that the situation quickly got out of hand. On March 1st, the gold pool dispensed an estimated 40 to 50 tons in London, as against 3 or 4 tons on a normal day. On March 5th and 6th, 40 tons per day. On March 8th, over 75 tons. And on March 13th, a total that could not be accurately estimated but ran well over 100 tons. Meanwhile, the pound, which could not possibly escape a further devaluation if the dollar were to be devalued in relation to gold, slipped below its par of $2.40 for the first time. Still another reiteration of the now familiar pledges, this time from the Central Bankers Club at Basel on March 10th, seemed to have no effect at all. The market was in a classic state of chaos, distrustful of every public assurance and at the mercy of every passing rumor. A leading Swiss banker grimly called the situation the most dangerous since 1931. A member of the Basel Club, tempering desperation with charity, said that the gold speculators apparently didn't realize their actions were imperiling the world's money. The New York Times, in an editorial, said, "It is quite clear that the international payments system is eroding." On Thursday, March 14th, panic was added to chaos. London gold dealers, in describing the day's action, used the un-British words stampede, catastrophe, and nightmare. The exact volume of gold sold that day was unannounced, as usual. Probably it could not have been precisely counted in any case. But everyone agreed that it had been an all-time record. Most estimates put the total at around 200 tons, or $220 million worth, while the Wall Street Journal put it twice that high. If the former estimate was right, during the trading day, the United States Treasury had paid out through its share of the gold pool alone $1 million in gold every 3 minutes and 42 seconds. If the journal figure was right, as a subsequent Treasury announcement made it appear to be, $1 million every 1 minute and 51 seconds. Clearly this wouldn't do. Like Britain in 1964, at this rate the United States would have a bare cupboard in a matter of days. That afternoon, the Federal Reserve System raised its discount rate from 4.5% to 5%, a defensive measure so timid and inadequate that one New York banker compared it to a pop gun, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, as the system's foreign exchange arm, was moved to protest by refusing to go along with the token raise. Late in the day in New York, and toward midnight in London, the United States asked Britain to keep the gold market closed the next day, Friday, to prevent further catastrophe and clear the way to the weekend, when face-to-face international consultations could be held. The bewildered American public, largely unaware of the gold pool's existence, probably first sensed the general shape of things when it learned on Friday morning that Queen Elizabeth II had met with her ministers on the crisis between midnight and 1 a.m. On Friday, a day of nervous waiting, the London markets were closed, and so were foreign exchange desks nearly everywhere else. But gold shot up to a big premium in the Paris market, a sort of black market from the American standpoint. And in New York, sterling, unsupported by the firmly locked Bank of England, briefly fell below its official bottom price of $2.38 before rallying. Over the weekend, the central bankers of the gold pool nations, the United States, Britain, West Germany, Switzerland, Italy, the Netherlands, and Belgium, with France still conspicuously missing and, indeed, uninvited this time, met in Washington with Coombs participating for the Federal Reserve, along with Chairman Martin. After 2 full days of rigidly secret discussions, while the world of money waited with bated breath, they announced their decisions late on Sunday afternoon. The $35 an ounce official monetary price of gold would be kept for use in all dealings among central banks. The gold pool would be disbanded, and the central banks would supply no more gold to the London market, where privately traded gold would be allowed to find its own price. Sanctions would be taken against any central bank seeking to profit from the price differential between the central bank price and the free market price. And the London gold market would remain closed for a couple of weeks until the dust settled. During the first few market days under the new arrangements, the pound rallied strongly, and the free market price of gold settled at between $2 and $5 above the central bank price, a differential considerably smaller than many had expected. The crisis had passed, or that crisis had. The dollar had escaped devaluation, and the International Monetary Mechanism was intact. Nor was the solution a particularly radical one. After all, gold had been on a two-price basis in 1960, before the gold pool had been formed. But the solution was a temporary stopgap one, and the curtain was not down on the drama yet. Like Hamlet's ghost, the pound, which had started the action, was offstage now. The principal actors onstage, as summer approached, were the Federal Reserve and the United States Treasury, doing what they could in a technical way to keep things on an even keel. The Congress, complacent with prosperity, preoccupied with coming elections, and therefore resistant to higher taxes and other uncomfortable retrenching measures. On the very afternoon of the London panic, the Senate Finance Committee had voted down an income tax surcharge. And finally, the president, calling for a program of national austerity to defend the dollar, yet at the same time carrying on at ever-increasing expense the Vietnam War, which had become as menacing to the health of America's money as, in the view of many, it was to that of America's soul. Ultimately, it appeared, the nation had just three possible economic courses: to somehow end the Vietnam War, root of the payments problem, and therefore heart of the matter; to adopt a full wartime economy, with sky-high taxes, wage and price controls, and perhaps rationing; or to face forced devaluation of the dollar and perhaps a depression-breeding world monetary mess. Looking beyond the Vietnam War and its incredibly broad worldwide monetary implications, the central bankers went on plugging away. 2 weeks after the stopgap solution of the dollar crisis, those of the 10 most powerful industrial countries met in Stockholm and agreed, with only France dissenting, on the gradual creation of a new international monetary unit to supplement gold as the bedrock underlying all currencies. It will consist, if action follows on resolution, of special drawing rights on the International Monetary Fund, available to nations in proportion to their existing reserve holdings. In bankers' jargon, the rights will be called SDRs. In popular jargon, they were at once called paper gold. The success of the plan in achieving its ends, averting dollar devaluation, overcoming the world shortage of monetary gold, and thus postponing indefinitely the threatened mess, will depend on whether or not men and nations can somehow at last, in a triumph of reason, achieve what they have failed to achieve in almost four centuries of paper money. That is, to overcome one of the oldest and least rational of human traits, the lust for the look and feel of gold itself, and come to give truly equal value to a pledge written on a piece of paper. The answer to that question will come in the last act, and the outlook for a happy ending is not bright. As the last act was beginning to unfold, after the sterling devaluation but before the gold panic, I went down to Liberty Street and saw Coombs and Hayes. I found Coombs looking bone-tired, but not sounding disheartened about 3 years spent largely in a losing cause. "I don't see the fight for the pound as all having been in vain," he said. "We gained those 3 years, and during that time the British put through a lot of internal measures to strengthen themselves. If they'd been forced to devalue in 1964, there's a good chance that wage and price inflation would have eaten up any benefit they derived and put them back in the same old box. Also, over those 3 years, there have been further gains in international monetary cooperation. Goodness knows what would have happened to the whole system with devaluation in 1964. Without that 3-year international effort, that rear-guard action, you might say, sterling might have collapsed in much greater disorder, with far more damaging repercussions than we've seen even now. Remember that, after all, our effort and the effort of the other central banks wasn't to hold up sterling for its own sake. It was to hold it up for the sake of preserving the system, and the system has survived." Hayes, on the surface, seemed exactly as he had when I last saw him, a year and a half earlier. as placid and unruffled as if he had been spending all that time studying up on Corfu. I asked him whether he was still living up to his principle of keeping banker's hours, and he replied, smiling very slightly, that the principle had long since yielded to expediency. That, as a time consumer, the 1967 sterling crisis had made the 1964 crisis seem like child's play, and that the subsequent dollar crisis was turning out to be more of the same. A side benefit of the whole 3.5-year affair, he said, was that its frequently excruciating melodrama had contributed something to Mrs. Hayes' interest in banking, and even something, if not so much, to the position of business in Tom's scale of values. When Hayes spoke of the devaluation, however, I saw that his placidity was a mask. "Oh, I was disappointed, all right," he said quietly. "After all, we worked like the devil to prevent it, and we nearly did. In my opinion, Britain could have got enough assistance from abroad to hold the rate. It could have been done without France. Britain chose to devalue. I think there's a good chance that the devaluation will eventually be a success. And the gain for international cooperation is beyond question. Charlie Coombs and I could feel that at Frankfurt in November, at the gold pool meeting, a sense everyone there had that now was the time to lock arms. But still," Hayes paused, and when he spoke again, his voice was full of such quiet force that I saw the devaluation through his eyes, not as just a severe professional reverse, but as an ideal lost and an idol fallen. He said, "That day in November, here at the bank, when a courier brought me the top-secret British document informing us of the decision to devalue, I felt physically sick. Sterling would not be the same. It would never again command the same amount of faith around the world." This is Johnny Heller. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Business Adventures, 12 Classic Tales from the World of Wall Street by John Brooks. Read for you by Johnny Heller. This program was directed by Rick Harris. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright, 1959, 1960, 1961, 1962, 1963, 1964, 1965, 1966, 1967, 1968, 1969 by John Brooks. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.